It's not uncommon to feel like I should be over this by now, but healing never follows a schedule. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I'm a total and complete shit show. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm a mom of two cats. I am a condiment lover. I am a cilantro hater. And I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship where we talk about what to do when you realize that the problems in your life are actually a result of your unresolved childhood wounds. So welcome aboard. And happy early Thanksgiving, guys. I did just want to give you a little tiny pep talk for Thanksgiving, remind you of a few things. As we know, the holidays are not the happiest time of the year for all of us, okay? So I just want to let you know that it is okay if you're not looking forward to Thanksgiving. It is okay if you're not feeling thankful right now. However you're feeling about this holiday is totally fine, valid. You are allowed to change your mind. You are allowed to show up late. You can leave early. You can skip it entirely. Please remember that no is a complete sentence. If you were going into a triggering situation, make sure you have a plan. Try to ground yourself before, have an exit plan. Have someone that you can reach out to if you need to. Give yourself permission to dissociate if you need to. Don't beat the shit out of yourself if you overeat or get triggered. Just remember, it's just another day. It's just another day. And if you are looking for some extra support, we will be having two groups tomorrow in the shit show. So we'll have one at 11 a.m. and then our regular group at 8:30 p.m. Both of those are in Eastern time. And we also have a community that is available to you all damn day in the chat. We are here for you if you need us. So today we are diving deep with returning guest, psychologist, author of Co-Crazy, recovering shit show herself, Dr. Sarah Michaud. And this is a fun conversation, not too heavy. I wanted to give you a little bit of a lighter episode for this holiday week. And this is just a good old fashioned conversation about what the hell this long-term recovery journey looks like. Because guys, I hate to break it to you, it never ends. It never ends. So let's just get on with the damn show. But first, Breathe to Heal goes on sale this Friday, this Black Friday. And as I said last week, we are calling this one Release and Receive. Most of us spend so much energy, you know, trying to build a better life, better boundaries, better relationships, better nervous system regulation, but we're trying to build it on top of everything that we are still carrying. And it doesn't work. Okay, because you can't receive what you want when your body is still protecting you from what you survived. The childhood wounds, the old coping mechanisms, the faulty beliefs that got wired into you when you were too young to question them, to know that they were bullshit. And they're not just in your head. Like, all of this shit is stored in your body, and it blocks us from everything that we're trying to create, everything that we're trying to call in. And so that is what this round is all about, actually releasing what's taking up space so you can finally make room for what you deserve. And January is when everyone's talking about resolutions and manifestations and intentions and all that shit. So if you're going to start the year off differently, let's start it with something that's actually going to change how your body responds to the world. Okay, this is the foundation that makes everything else possible. So again, this starts on Tuesday, January 13th. It's 7 weeks. Fellow shit show Teresa is facilitating. She just finished her second breathwork certification, so she's bringing some new practices to this round. And it goes on sale this Black Friday, and we will have early bird pricing through December 10th. We also have a 2 and 3 month payment plan options if that makes this more accessible to you. This is limited capacity, and the last two rounds sold out. So don't sleep on this shit, y'all. Don't sleep on this shit. Get your damn spot. Just do it. Just do it. Just do it. Next, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to DM the Join Shit Show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups, where we have 2 groups on Thanksgiving Day, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. You guys, there's nothing else out there like this community. We had a meeting on Sunday that was just so beautiful and amazing. Everyone was getting real, raw, honest, sharing their struggles. And then we're also like able to make jokes and laugh too. This is a fun community of people who are really dedicated to doing this work, that really want to break the cycle. So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, let's just do it already, okay? We just had another person that just signed up. She just found me after listening to the Crappy Childhood Fairy episode last week, and she already signed up. I think it's Jolene. Okay, so let's channel our inner Jolene and just DM the join already. See the link in the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshownext. Give me a follow on Insta and TikTok at adultchildpod, and last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. I mean it. Do it. Thank you. Love you all. Well, she's back. We have therapist, author of Co-Crazy. What is the name of your YouTube channel? Leaving Crazy Town?
Yeah.
Dr. Sarah Michaud, welcome back.
Andrea, a pleasure to be here. Mm. Always a pleasure to chat with you. We have a lot of fun.
Yes. I was listening back to our first interview. I was such a baby. I thought I was so much more healed than I thought I was.
Do you know what you were wearing?
No. My pajamas?
No. I don't know if I should even say it. You were in your underwear.
Oh. It was probably hot. Was it hot?
Andrea, it was my first podcast. And I'm
that's
sitting
so Andrea.
There, and I'm like, I wonder if
I have sweatpants on. But I do have pants on.
No, but this is the thing. You stood up. It wasn't like you stayed seated. And I don't want to shame you because I love you.
Care?
Yeah, you don't care. All right. So I'm on there and we're chatting. And suddenly, and I'm like trying to, like I have all my notes. And you stand up and you turn around and you walk to your refrigerator because you were in your kitchen. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, is this normal? Like, are people in their underwear interviewing people?
Not normal.
I was like, is this a boundary thing? Like, I was like worried about you. I wanted to take care of you.
Sorry.
It was just so hilarious in a way because I was like, I had not had the experience before. Oh my God.
I don't think anybody has. That's so funny.
It cracked me right open. Oh my God.
I got pants on.
All I kept thinking was, God, I hope she doesn't do this with the male guests.
You're the only person that's ever told me that, but former guests, let a gal know. I don't think that was a normal thing for me.
You might have been really stressed that day. I mean, who knows? It was post-COVID. I mean, maybe people
were
just...
Was I in San Francisco?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing I could like give myself a break on... Yes. There's no excusing that I like stood up and did that. But the only excuse that I give myself for... being in my underwear would be I didn't have AC, and like there were times when it would get really hot. So it just depends on what time of the year. If it was like those 2 weeks when there's an, they call it an Indian summer. If it was that, I'll give myself a break. If not, like, hey, I thought I was a lot more healed than I thought I was.
You know what? I mean, that is something I totally believe. People disagree about this, but the idea of we do the best we can when I really believe everything I've done at any particular time in my recovery was exactly what I was capable of doing at that time. I mean, I really do, because I've made plenty of mistakes in my recovery. And I look back, like we were talking about you being 35 or 36, and I got married when I was 39. And I mean, when I look back and did work on that, I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a child. I was 39 years old. And I, in my head, and I was in love with this guy. I mean, I thought he was wonderful. And he's obviously my son's dad, and we've worked it out. But when I look back, I go, wow, the decisions I was making at that time were clearly out of fear. And so, you know, we learn, we grow, we change, we do better.
Mm-hmm. And we do podcasts in our underwear.
And we do podcasts in our underwear, and we do the best we can.
Yeah. Maybe one thing, if it was like, I'm looking to see what number episode it was. Like, I wish it was like number 5, but it was like number 56. I mean, I had already been on the Dr. Drew podcast by this point. So like, yes, I should have had some pants on. So hopefully it was just
hot. It was
hot.
Whatever. Right. It was hot. Whatever.
It's so exactly. Andrea. I'm embracing it.
That's the thing. Embrace it. And I really am into the forgiveness. Like, no shame. Like, I mean, my gosh, I could... Yeah. No shame.
What a first podcast experience for you. Okay.
It was great. We talked for a long time, though. I do remember we had a great conversation.
So I've gone back through it.
Okay.
Because I wanted to see where the holes were and where I wanted to go. I have a lot of things.
Okay.
Here's where I think I want to start, though.
Okay.
It was interesting because you made the comment on like being sick of the term codependency. And so... this is actually like a challenge to both of us.
Okay.
So like I refer to myself as like a recovering shit show. I'll say I was like a total psycho when I think about how I was in relationships. And when I use these terms, like it is genuinely about trying to add some levity and almost like humanizing it in a way, like making it less precious or like less heavy. Like if I can laugh at it, like, you know, it loses some of the power over it. But I have a friend who really challenges me on this, especially like from the perspective of like IFS, you know, that there might be parts of me that hear that language and really believe that, you know? And so she's always just pushing back on me. Like when she hears me say certain things, like I'm crazy or this or that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering from you, like, have you ever received that sort of pushback from like terming codependency as like co-crazy? And is that like reinforcing this idea that there's something wrong with us as opposed to it being a completely understandable response to the childhood experiences that we had?
Yes. I mean, you and I are on the total same page. I mean, I was just emailing someone this morning about, you know, I worked at McLean Hospital and one of my best friends, our sense of humor with each other about mental illness, a lot of people would be offended. But when you work at a psych hospital, if you don't have a sense of humor and make jokes about it, you'd kill yourself.
You will be in the psych hospital.
Yeah, you'd be in the psych hospital. So, I mean, I'm not trying to be insensitive to anybody. But I definitely think we cannot lose our sense of humor. And the reason I called it co-crazy, and I think people misunderstand this. In fact, a feminist podcaster, I think, took offense. And I tried to explain this, that most people that came into my office, when they were in relationships and struggling and getting sober, they felt crazy. That was how they felt. And so when I say co-crazy, I really talk about it that when you're in a relationship with either an active alcoholic or just someone who's troubled or someone who's blaming you or someone who's gaslighting you or someone who's, you know, saying it's all your fault, or someone who's leaving for 3 days and then coming back and saying it's normal and why are you upset, you start to feel crazy. And it's really, I was talking more about the feeling of it rather than actually the what it really, you know, the word crazy meaning you're crazy. I don't mean it that way at all. I just mean as though when I was first getting sober and when I've been in certain relationships before I really started healing, I felt crazy. And so I wanted to give space to that. And that's why I called it that, you know, because a lot of people feel that way when they can't understand what's going on in an intimate relationship. So that's really why. Yeah.
I know, I'm not offended by it. It was just.
I get it. And I know some people probably are. And yet I really think it's important to have some spaciousness and lightness about ourselves. I mean, you know this. I mean, and I was thinking about you this morning and thinking you're super smart. And when I've listened to some of the pods, I was listening to a couple coming home from the Cape the other day, you know, because I try to keep up on what's happening. And yet sometimes I'm not a super intellectual. I mean, my dad was a Princeton Harvard man. So like I grew up with four brothers, Ivy League, a dad like that, lots of intellectualism. And you know what? It didn't solve his problems at all. So I'm someone that is always simplifying. You know what I mean? I don't want to get down into the weeds and figure out another theory and figure out, geez, we're going to talk about this angle. And because you know what? Because I've been around so long, now there's tons of new books, but they're basically saying similar stuff to what I was learning in the 80s. It's just a different language set. And so I try not to get too much down that road of like intellectualizing, because you know what, Andrea? My clients who were the doctors, the well-known scientists, the, you know, the famous authors at McLean, they were the hardest patients because they thought they were going to think their way out of it. And they could not get the idea that their brains weren't going to solve it. And addiction is not like that. So, I mean, you know what? I mean, having more information, I guess, is good to a certain degree, but information and knowledge, it's really about behavior change. I mean, I was thinking of someone I sponsor recently, and, you know, some of the women that come to me have been sober a really long time. They have all the knowledge about codependency or trauma or this and that, but their behaviors are not changing. So to me, if you're still yelling at your kids and you're 23 years sober and you have all the knowledge about why, that's not going to necessarily stop you. All right, I'm on a rant. I'm sorry. But yeah, I mean, so I know you like meet all these new authors and all these brilliant folks, and that's like great. And I'm sure you've learned a ton. And yet when it comes down to really changing, I've got to change my behaviors. Yeah. So,
yeah. And I think that for me, it was in learning that sometimes like thinking that I can just change my behavior by changing the behavior.
Got it.
You know, like, and like sometimes realizing that like it is a nervous system thing. You know, like I think about like procrastination and just like how I've, yeah.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with like being lazy or unmotivated.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's like literally me going into like a state of fight flight.
Yes.
Whether it's like whatever the task is. And I realize that it's not the fear of the task, right? It's fear of being judged, of failing, of disappointing somebody. And so just thinking that I can just snap into it and do it.
Absolutely.
It has been about like, I've had to like learn how to like regulate my body and like learn how to feel safe.
Yeah.
And so I do think that that is like where a lot of people get it wrong or they feel confused. Like I'm trying to change this behavior. I'm trying to stop doing this. And they're just like going about it in the wrong way, you know?
Well, it's so funny you're bringing that up because I'm in a class right now I don't know, this woman you should have on your podcast. Her name's Linda Tai, and she's a
therapist. I'd love to have her on.
Yeah, she's great. And she's 10 years sober, but she's brilliant about all these.
She's into the nervous system, right?
She's all about, yeah, she does. She's a combination of a bunch of different therapies. But everybody talks about now, the language now is, she says, well, my nervous system and your nervous. So it's all about, I get that. I mean, my first husband took a workshop with Peter Levine 25 years ago. So, I mean, it's not like this stuff hasn't been around. It has in certain arenas, and he was in California. So, I mean, it's been around. I think the psychological world didn't catch up with it until, you know, Besser van der Kolk and Peter Levine and people started, and Gabor Maté, and more people started getting in touch with it, and others, I'm sure. But I agree with you that, like, yes, a nervous system thing, I've had to learn, you know, what are my go-to states, the fight, flight, or freeze, and all of that. And when am I noticing my body, and all the tools I've learned over the years. I mean, I've talked to you about somatic experiencing, I think was like one of the best therapies I've ever done. So yes, and it's like everybody's talking now about everything being biological. I think I get a little, not resistant, but there's something about focusing on the body. Yes, we have these automatic responses. Yes, and we still have to take responsibility.
So, yeah, I don't think it's not taking responsibility.
No, I agree. I think it sometimes reminds me, though, like when I'm on this class of, I don't know, there's a very fine line between, it's like when I used to have a client come in and they just wanted a third or fourth medication. And it's like, well, what are you doing about the rest of it? Do you know what I mean? And again, I agree with you. And it's all of it. It's psychological, it's emotional, it's physiological, it's spiritual, it's intellectual, it's all of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the thing too is, like, we all have different experiences.
Yeah.
And like different healing. And
yes.
I think about some of like friends that I've had and how they've been able to like change certain behaviors like in an easy way. And then I just like reflect upon my experience of being stuck in functional freeze. And I still kind of struggle with it to an extent, like procrastination, overthinking certain things. Like I still struggle with it to an extent. And it's the shame that I felt in just not understanding why I can't just like snap out of it. And I think that for people who haven't, and there's certain things that other people can't figure out and work through that like is perplexing to me that I can't relate to.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's not just like about the body. It's like parts work too. But I think that's like it.
It's all of it.
Yeah. It's like it's all certain things like are really
hard,
you know, or just take a long time and a long time in figuring out what's going to work for you. You might have to try like a bunch of different things. And there's a part of me that feels maybe like a little bit envious of people who can have an easier time with certain things.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So.
Well, and it's interesting because, and this is a little bit of a topic jump, but when mm-hmm. that book Let Them came out, you know, Mel Robbins wrote that mm-hmm. book. And I had such a strong reaction to it. And I know tons of people love that book. But the thing is, it's like, it's not that easy. I mean, yeah, I can let them. First of all, I mean, I've been working with people in codependency for over 30 years. If everybody could just let them, I wouldn't have a job. Do you know what I mean? So there was a couple of things about that. I just felt as though she didn't get to like, and then the solution was let me, of course. And then her solution also was about, well, I'm not going to even get into her book, but the thing
is, what was her solution?
The solution was let me, but it was really still about responding to them. It was not, she didn't get into the let me enough. And she didn't talk about the underlying emotional, you know.
I think that book is for the normies.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet most people struggle with wanting other people in their lives to change. So, I mean, I do think it's a common thing where people, I mean, it's on a spectrum, obviously, but, you know, she gives a lot of examples. And the thing that we forget is, I mean, she just wrote the book a few years ago. She struggled with her own alcoholism. She raised her kids and she and her husband were both drinking. And, you know, a lot of her, what I would call codependency controlling behavior, she just had these discoveries in the last few years and started looking at it. So
she also stole like the title from a poet. There's a lot of things, like there's some inconsistencies in her story. So that's what I have an issue with.
Yes, I know.
So I think that there's some...
There's a lot there.
There's some grifting going on there. So I'm not a fan of it either.
There's been a lot of different opinions.
But I mean, it's helped a lot of people, which is like great.
Exactly. It's helped a lot.
I think also it could force people to... To me, I think it could reinforce self-abandonment.
Yes.
And also be like, why can't I just let them? Like, what is wrong with me? Like, and trying to force yourself into accepting something that is perhaps unacceptable.
Right. Right. Yes. And that's what I mean. It's just way more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you're talking about, we have these childhoods, we develop these skills, whatever they are, everybody's got a different, you know, bunch of them. And we use these things to survive, to feel safe, and I'm simplifying. And the problem is we keep using them as adults. We don't know, maybe some of them aren't working for us and getting us into trouble.
And that can create more trauma.
And create more trauma, absolutely. And so it's complicated. And yeah, it's just way more complicated than that. And some of these, you know, some of these tools or some of these things that were skills back then, now that aren't working for me, they can still get activated. I mean, I was just thinking of this example of, this is going to sound like a crazy example, but my sweetheart, the guy I'm dating is a total foodie, right? He loves like really special foods. Now, I don't even cook. Okay.
I'm a foodie.
Yeah. So we have some great things in common and we have some other things. So it was his birthday and I went to this specialty shop and I walk in and I immediately have like a thing in my body of not feeling good enough because I don't even know what the different foods are and I'm not like a cheese person and I don't know caviar. And so I'm immediately like in this kind of, wow, having some self-esteem. I'm walking around and I ask this woman, I say, hey, could you make me like a small basket of just like two or three things that are kind of expensive, specialty foods? I'm on my way up to New Hampshire. I'm going to give my sweetheart this gift. I know he would really love it. He loves certain, you know, he told me he loved this caviar he hasn't had in a long time. All right. So I say this to this woman, right? She goes out back. She comes out with this basket. You can't see my arms. This huge basket. And she holds it up and she says, is this going to work? Now, in a split second, I knew it wasn't going to work. I didn't want that basket. I didn't want to have a bunch of things. And yet, what came out of my mouth? Sure. Sure. Now, I've been like in codependency recovery and addiction recovery, empowerment for women for years. At that moment, it was so quick. I was in a hurry. But when I, you know, when I unpacked it later, it's like, why do I care about her feelings? Why didn't I spend 5 minutes thinking, no, that basket isn't going to... Long story short, I end up driving to New Hampshire with a huge gift basket with all these crappy foods. They were not expensive and good. They were like, you know, and I was enraged. And like, that's just a small example.
Yourself or at her?
At myself. Because I'm like, why did I not say no? I mean, I was literally shocked at my behavior. And I thought, what was that? And it was a combination of several things. It was old fear got activated, which of course isn't about her. I don't even know her. Like fear of someone getting upset with me. It was like an old physiological reaction from dad, probably. But that to me is just one tiny example of how codependency slash whatever you want to name it, our histories are impacting our present. Now that stuff happens all day long to people. Whether it's someone at the store, whether it's your partner, whether it's your child, whether it's your parent, whether it's your boss. And if we don't like start identifying it, where it's getting in our way, we are basically living false lives. And, you know, my definition of codependency is basically I'm unable to be myself in relationship. I mean, that's really the bottom line of it. We could say, oh, I'm trying to fix, change, or save someone else. But I'm doing that because I can't be who I want to be. I'm too afraid. So I think I need to be someone else to be okay with them. And so, I mean, which is a, many human beings experience whether they grow up in addiction or not. Yeah. So anyways, I went off
on
a rant.
When you said yes to her, did you feel it in your body right away?
You know what's funny? I felt like this thing in my body, like this isn't right. And then I immediately said to myself, you're in a hurry. It doesn't matter. It's like the dismissing. Like, it doesn't matter. You rationalize. I mean, what humans do, we make decisions and then our brains make up a reason to make it okay, right? So it wasn't until I was literally almost to New Hampshire that it really hit me. And then I'm just like, okay, sir, forgive yourself, move on, look at the anger. What was it about? But it shocked me. It shocked me, Andrew, because I thought, you know, and I think I said that to you when you did your first podcast about being in that relationship. I said, I wrote this book because at 20 years sober, I'm seeing 30 patients a week. I've worked at a very prestigious psych hospital. I've been in Al-Anon for 20 years. I've been sober for, you know, a zillion. I'm a psychologist. My husband relapsed and my life falls apart. So it doesn't matter how much work we've done, how much education we have. There are moments when we can't, you know, see the forest through the trees or whatever the saying is. Yeah.
That was something that I was going to bring up. So that was like a perfect segue. Cause I don't even know if we got into that relationship, like in our first interview, but
right.
You got married to somebody that you had met in recovery and he ended up relapsing. And, you know, I was thinking about it from the perspective of like, you grew up in an alcoholic home, no matter how much work you had done, it's totally unrealistic to think that you be in that situation and you wouldn't slip into some sort of codependent behavior. Now, the severity of that might vary how long you stay in the relationship with somebody who's active. Like all of that can differ, but we're never going to be healed to the point where like that experience of growing up in an alcoholic home is going to completely like leave us as if we never experienced it. So like, it's totally unrealistic to think of that. But upon like reflection, like you had gone to codependency. Did you go to inpatient treatment?
For codependency?
Yeah.
When I was 10 years sober and I was in a doctorate program, I went to a treatment that was, that was for like underlying issues. So I don't, it wasn't—
Was it inpatient?
Yeah, it was like a residential.
Was it, did you go to the Meadows?
No. Okay. It was in Montreal.
Okay.
So
like you had, so you had worked on all this stuff, right? But I'm curious, like upon reflection, do you feel a lot of the work that you had done up until that point was solely based off of like symptoms and behaviors and not really getting to the root?
No, I think, like you said, I mean, I think even though my life imploded, meaning I did never think I'd be living with an active person, I think because of all the work I did, it did not last forever. I did handle it in an appropriate way. A lot of great stuff came out of it. And again, I mean, the person I chose, like if I look at it from a positive point of view, and then I'll get into the other stuff. Like I chose a guy that was 15 years sober, that was super kind, that was loving, that, I mean, like there was a lot of great stuff. I mean, I really thought I'd found the man of my dreams.
And you obviously always have the risk of somebody relapsing if you're like, there's the wonderful parts that come with it. You connect, you're on the same page, you have a connection that like you wouldn't get with somebody else, but there's always a risk that somebody could relapse.
And you know what's so mind-blowing is that literally never occurred to me. I mean, talk about, I just thought, I don't know why. I mean, plenty of people had relapsed that I'd known, but we got married. My son was 5 at the time. And I don't know, this is weird to think about, but you do think sometimes about, you hear these stories, and I've heard them for years, that sometimes certain men who have not resolved certain things, you get married and something happens. And I'm not sure what happened for him.
I think
him.
That happens for not just it men. For women, I think that it happens. This just shows up in relationship.
This shows up in relationship. Right. And so once we got married and started living together, he had a company. Like all this stuff was there when we got married, but you could see the slow decline. Like suddenly his business partner turns out was an alcoholic and, you know, was, you know, doing things with the money. And like all these things started to happen. And this person that I had married suddenly started to seem really different. Then he had a surgery, right? So then he started taking opiates for the surgery. And then I'm questioning that. And then eventually the company went, and then like he's out of work for a while. Then he gets in a motorcycle accident, more opiates. So it was like this slow, you know, kind of decline. And meanwhile, I'm working full time and I have a son at home. And so it's like parenting, you're busy. And I remember, and I think I say this in early in the book, like this scene where I go to reach for shoes and I pull the shoebox down and a bunch of pills came down. And I remember that moment of almost like your life is like, you're totally confused, but everything makes sense at the same time. Like maybe this isn't why this worked out and that worked out. And so from that time till the time I asked him to leave was not super long. He attempted 2 treatments and neither worked. And then I asked him to leave. So, I mean, we did do a bunch of stuff where I tried to handle it. I think the thing that was so upsetting to me was my emotional world. Like I had all this shame. How could I be living with an addict? I had all this guilt about my son having someone who's active. I mean, I would have never wanted someone to be around that. So all of those things got back into therapy again. So I don't think I was, I mean, I'm sure there were things that weren't healed. I think there's always new things like this relationship I'm in now. But I mean, I think I was in pretty good shape to resolve it. I just think, I thought to myself, and why I wrote the book was, I have all this knowledge, I have all this experience, I have a degree, and yet it's really hard. And I thought, how is the average human being handling something like this? You know, I mean, it's really hard.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think that it would have been, it's unrealistic to think that like you wouldn't have a response. So what was the process for you of resolving the shame that you felt? Was that something that took a while for you? Because you know what? Even in the first interview, there was a quote, you know, that you didn't even, it was like one line actually that you said about that marriage. It was like, I don't even want to think about that. Like, oh, and that's like so shame. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, well, since I've talked to you, it's really interesting, and this is kind of a really cool story. I went through the steps again, and he was never on my amend list, and yet, you know, you're married for a period of time. There's stuff I did, too, and I always...
How long were you married?
We got married in 2004. He left in 2011.
And how long into the relationship did he initially relapse, you know?
Well, probably sooner than I know. Yeah, probably sooner than I know. But within a couple of years, he was taking different things for, like, he'd have the surgery and then this happened and then that happened. So it was, and that's what's so tricky because, you know, it can seem like something's resolved, but it may not be resolved. You know what I mean? Like, and then something happens again and you're back in the, you know, you're back in the problem again. I mean, that's part of what's so tricky. But the shame piece, yeah, I mean, I think the last several years have been a lot around me feeling like the most important thing is forgiveness of self. And I think part of that work was doing this amend. And this is kind of a cool story. So he passed away, by the way. And when I did some work with a new sponsor, I decided to go up to this beach in Maine and I made my list of amends and I was going to drive up there and walk to the beach and do my amends. And so I get to this parking lot and next to me, this guy was getting out of a car at the same time and it was super early in the morning. And what's the first thing I think? George is sending me my next husband. My first thought, like, I'm like, oh, this is too coincidental. So this guy gets out of his car. We say hi. You know, I go to the beach. He goes and does his thing. He's going for a walk or something. I go to the beach. I go to the spot we used to sit. I read my amends. I have my emotions. You know, I have this really cool experience of freedom and like completion, etc. And I always use that word around, you know, this work, like you find freedom. And so I, you know, it's time to leave. It's like quite a long walk back to my car. And right as I get to my car, the same guy is getting to his car. And we start chatting. And it turns out he was a physician and he was up for the day and blah, blah, blah. And we just have this kind of nice exchange. And then just as I'm about to get in my car, I have this thought, like ask him where he's from. And so I say, hey, where are you coming from? And he says, freedom. And I said, freedom? And he said, freedom, New Hampshire. I just thought that was like the universe. It was one of those moments, Andrea, where it was like,
can you feel it? Yeah.
I got it. Yeah. Yeah. It was very cool. So yeah, I feel like for whatever reason that, you know, that piece is I hope, resolved for now.
All right, Chichos, the holidays are here, and if you still have names on your list, if you have gifts that you still need to buy, what the heck are you doing? Okay, because I've been telling you about Uncommon Goods for the past 2 months, who make holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You will discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. They look for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade, and they have something for everyone, for mom, dad, kids, teens, book lovers, sports fans, foodies, you name it, they got it. Listen to what I just stumbled upon. I just stumbled upon a crochet your own emotional support desk plant kit, a DIY kit for you to be able to crochet an emotional support desk plant. There's got to be somebody out there that has a crocheter in their life that needs this emotional support desk plant. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. And so to get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/adultchild. That's uncommongoods.com/adultchild for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. All right, Chichos, did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps? It affects 1 in 3 adults, and especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, brain fog, weakness, brittle nails, but the problem is that most people don't realize that low iron may be the cause of these issues. That's why I'm here to tell you about Siderol from Pharma Nutra. This is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while also avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea, constipation, and all that fun stuff. It is clinically proven to be comparable to IV iron and is formulated with just 2 ingredients, iron and vitamin C. It's vegan, allergen-free, gluten-free. You can take it anytime, anywhere. So if you're that 1 out of 3 with an iron deficiency, head to pharmanutra-us.com and use code ADULTCHILD Child for 10% off your first order. That is PHARMANUTRA-US.com. Promo code Adult Child for 10% off today.
But shame is tricky. I mean, it's really interesting that you brought shame up because I went to a function on Saturday night. A friend of mine has these game nights, which are super fun. And a bunch of us got together for this game night. And there were two things that happened that I woke up the next morning and had kind of a shame feeling. One was he has a dog and I picked up the dog in the wrong way. And the dog like yelped in pain. And I was like, oh my God. And I've known this dog for years. So it's not, and I had this immediate shame response. Like, oh my God, how could I have done that? Blah, blah, blah. You know, why didn't I know that? And then another experience where this woman, I was talking about something with this woman and this other woman said, hey, maybe we should stop talking. I don't know. She kind of, I felt like shamed me a little bit. Anyways, the great thing about my friends is this. I woke up the next morning. I had those two thoughts. I wrote about it. I did my morning routine. Within a half an hour, both those people involved in those two events texted me and made amends. And it's like, you know, that is so cool to me because the people I'm in relationship with right now, when something happens like that, we clear it up. And I just love that. So am I capable of feeling shame today? Of course, you know, but hopefully, you know, I have relationships in my life where people aren't like shaming me. I mean, yeah. Anyways. So yeah, hopefully I've worked through that past relationship. And, you know, I feel like we learn something through every relationship we have, right?
Of course. Yeah. So what does that process of like self-forgiveness look like for you over the past few years? And was there something that led up to you making that a focus?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know if it's age. I don't know if it's just getting to a certain place in my recovery. I mean, I read tons of books. I've been studying Buddhism forever. I mean, there's something about spaciousness with ourselves and kindness with ourselves and not taking things personally. And I mean, the greatest thing about studying mindfulness is I learned years ago, we are not our thoughts. So, I mean, I have a lot of spaciousness with my thoughts. I think the body sensations and the feeling of the shame stuff has taken longer. I don't know how specifically it just came into my vortex for some reason. This whole idea of like, you know what, Sarah, it's like diet and exercise. Being a woman on the planet, we can obsess about our bodies and our looks forever. And it's the same thing. You reach a point where you're like, okay, that one I got to let go of. I mean, I don't want to be 80 years old still worrying about my weight. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I mean, I think it's just being kind to ourselves. And that whole idea that I really have done the best I could, and I still do. You know, the whole idea of not having to be perfect. And I think when you get a degree or you're in this work like you, I mean, you know, we do these behaviors and we think for some reason we're above it. And my feeling is we do things less and less over time, absolutely. And we handle situations a lot differently. But there's always going to be some new level of something to heal. I mean, because new events happen all the time. You know, mm-hmm.
Hate to break it to you folks.
Yeah.
That's a nice segue too, because I did want to talk to you about the body stuff. Because in your book, you have like a section on the body and talking about how you, when you started doing somatic therapy, that you had been, you know, so disconnected from your body. And so I'm just like curious about if you could just talk about kind of the progression of the relationship with your body. And I know that you struggled with food. That was your first addiction.
Right.
And just what that journey has looked like for you, and was the somatic work and the feeling of being disconnected. Like, I'm assuming that's obviously tied probably to the weight and the food stuff as
well. Right. It's fascinating because you're right. It is a long journey. And I think it's a long journey for lots of women. I mean, how many women do you know in program or in recovery that have had food and body issues? I mean, pretty much almost all the ones I've met. And still now today, I mean, I have a bunch of pals and some of them are still struggling with stuff. And I do think addiction, so I was an addict, active addict from 16 to 24, but I was really an addict way before then with the food. I mean, in elementary school, I was coming home and pounding Twinkies. So from whatever age, I was trying to escape and soothe myself. And the food, and it's really funny, even now, like suddenly I'll notice I bought some ice cream or something and I'll be like, I wonder what's happening for me. Because ice cream was always, when I was a kid, the self-soothing. It was just, and I do believe physiological, there's something about it, the texture, the sugar, the fat, the combo that does something to your brain. Absolutely. This woman, I can't remember her name right now, has a big community for food addicts online, talks a lot about that. But yeah, it just was this way that was programmed into me for self-soothing. And the problem is, as a kid and then as an adolescent, I put on a bunch of weight. And the food addiction and then later alcohol and drugs were a way to just be out of myself. I mean, I would check out and disassociate in a lot of ways when I was a kid, but that was just another level. So I think I was just out of my body for a variety of reasons. I mean, I also had some sexual trauma stuff with some, you know, sexual violence when I was in active addiction. So, I mean,
were there comments by either of your parents, like related to body stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, my dad, and this was really tricky when I first got into therapy, that, you know, my dad, I was not an incest survivor from my dad, but there was Paul Gilmartin, and I talk a lot about this, Paul from the Mental Illness Happy Hour. I mean, you know, we talk about that covert incest. I mean, my father, for years, slapped me on the ass, called me provocative names. At one point, I remember like fixing some dinner, and when he walked by me, he actually put his hand down my pants and squeezed my ass. So, I mean, I say it's covert because nobody addressed it. And I was so used to it that I thought it was normal. But the problem with that is back then, you know, the big PTSD stuff, there was no language for that. And I do remember when the Courage to Heal book came out. This was a book on sexual, you know, sexual abuse. And I remember reading that book and thinking, my God, this is me. And yet I wouldn't have categorized myself that way. But I had all of the symptoms. You know, my identity was how I got attention, like my sexual being and all that stuff. And so it was really tricky kind of identifying that because of growing up with him and it not
was all being, you knew.
Yes. And it was not so obvious. You know, Paul and I talk a lot about the bathroom stuff because my father, and this is so weird to even say to you, when I would be in the bathroom, he would come and pound on the door and he thought it was funny. And like scare me. And so I've actually, I have a bladder illness. I have something called interstitial cystitis, which is a chronic inflammation of the bladder. And I don't know if it happened because of those violations. I don't know. I always had like, whenever we'd go out early on, I always had to go to the bathroom. So I did have frequent urination, but it couldn't have helped. And so, yeah, just strange bathroom stuff. And so, yeah, I do believe there was lots of reasons why I didn't want to be in my body. And then you add on like active years of addiction and sexual stuff, more reasons to not be in my body. So when I got sober, I did a lot of therapy. I did a lot of AA. I joined actually a sexual recovery group therapy and talked a lot about it, but it was all in my, it was all a psychological and emotional process. It was not about the body. And even though I got into a bunch of physical activities, I got into shape, I started working out with weights, I became a gym rat, I ran for a bunch of years. So I have done a bunch of physical stuff, but I still was not really in my body. And it took a long time in recovery to get there. And I think through meditation over time, like after I got into recovery for a period of time, step work, therapy, meditation quieted me down when I started studying Buddhism. But yeah, it's been an on. Then when I was in California in graduate school, I started doing yoga. And I remembered being in yoga classes and sobbing in certain positions because we would have to be present and it was quiet and I would be in my body. So it's just been this ongoing process. And then doing somatic work.
Was there a catalyst that led you into that?
Not into the yoga.
No, into the somatic.
Oh, in a
experiencing.
Well, my first husband, who I was married to in 1999, was a yoga teacher. And he had done all this somatic training with Peter Levine. And so he and I, you know, he started, you know, doing workshops himself. And I started to get into it. And I started doing what was called, it's like yoga somatic therapy. It was a type of somatic therapy.
I don't know why I thought you had like chronic pain or like stomach issues or something.
No. I mean, I think when I said when I was a kid, I was on Tagamet when I was like 10 years old. So I think I did have like gastritis, and that was, it's interesting. I'm topic jumping, but doing the Linda Tai work right now with the body, she talks a lot about these motions and exercise to free up the diaphragm, because it is true. We hold so much in that stomach area. I mean, that's where so much of the trauma stuff for me, I think, was held early on. So yeah, I mean, and I do believe just the chronic tension. I mean, I think that's so much of the work too, is just releasing, like you talk about the armoring, learning how to be okay with releasing the tension in our bodies. And I think for years, I didn't even know my body was tense. I mean, I'm sure you had that experience, like you start doing this work and you're like, wow, I didn't even realize my shoulders were up here, or I was having chronic stomach aches or hip pain or whatever. So yeah, it is definitely an ongoing process. And I do think the somatic work, I mean, what blows my mind about the somatic experiencing stuff is I know initially it was hard. Like I noticed I'd want to talk about stuff and the person would say, no, what are you experiencing in your body? And I like even to get a different language. It is a different language. Give me the sensations in your body. We don't need to talk about an event. So it's been a journey. And this is what I'll say about my present relationship that has to do with this. So I started dating this guy a year and a half ago. It's been beautiful.
When was the last time you dated?
So I hadn't dated. George left in 2011. I decided no dating. I need to raise my child. I need to launch him. Didn't date at all. Just focused on my work. In like 2017, I dated one guy for 3 months.
How'd that go?
I probably had a moment like, I got to go on a date, or I'm going to dry up and die. That was very adult to me. I handled it appropriately. I never slept with him. We just dated and I felt like I did a good job. And I started going on dating sites and stuff. Then I dated another guy briefly for 3 months after that. And COVID happened. And this, so like 2 years ago, I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to be 65. Like I was still feeling like I wanted to share my life with someone. And it's much different when you're not looking for like, well, it shouldn't be much different. I was going to say for the father of your children, but you're into, you know, now it's about having a partner to like do things with. It's not necessary. It's different. It's liberating actually. So I went on Bumble and met this guy. And to be honest with you, for the first time, he is someone that has the same upbringing I do, kind of socioeconomic wise, same similar experience with his parents. I mean, And I know I
was there alcoholism in his family?
Yeah, his dad. And even though his dad was a famous Jungian analyst.
Of course he was.
Yeah, of course he was. And yes. And he, and I didn't know it because he didn't say on his thing, but he's in recovery. So we met and totally hit it off.
Did that come out on the first date?
Say that. Yeah, it came out on the first date. We went for a 3-hour walk. And it's really interesting. I was going to say this to you about dating too. This is my tip to anyone who's starting to date, is the way I've seen it in the last 10 years over dating that really works for me is it's like you're walking on railroad tracks, not in a bad way, in a good way. Meaning one side of the railroad track is like, oh my God, this guy's hot. Oh my God, he's gorgeous. Oh my God, I want to kiss him. Oh my God, I want to jump his bones. Oh my God. It's the kind of like the delusion, the fantasy and all the projections and also the physiological, like I just want it part of us, right? So there's this kind of addict part that just, you know, that first 3 months. And at the same time, there's another railroad track and it's the rational mind. And it's like, geez, okay, these are some nice parts about him. Geez, what are some things that I'm seeing? Some red flags or some parts that we may not connect on. And for me, those first 3 to 6 months of dating is about kind of navigating between those tracks. Because, I mean, I was just listening to Jillian. She's like a relationship expert. I can't remember her last name. And she said, people spend more time like purchasing a pair of shoes than deciding who they're going to marry. And it's like, you know what I mean? And it's so true. Like you feel like some people just feel like, I mean, how many times have you had a friend that says, I met the person last night and I know this is it. You know what I mean? And it's like, all I think to myself is, yeah, just wait 3 months. You know what I mean? Because those first 3 months are just that projection land. So anyways, we met. It's been really great. He was a social worker, like he was in the same field for many years. He's retired. He's now back to work in another field. But one thing that started, oh my God, I almost cried just then. One thing that happened is I couldn't fall asleep. I could not fall asleep. So I hadn't slept overnight with someone for years. And now, you know, he lives an hour away in New Hampshire and we're traveling. He comes down here. I go, and I was clearly in a trauma response because the minute I would lay there and he'd fall asleep in a second, of course, and I'd be laying there and my anxiety would start. And I'd be like, something is happening in my body. I'm having an activation. So even though, again, I've been feeling great, and you always hear this from girlfriends, I'm feeling great. And then I got in a relationship and everything gets activated. So I had to like call my old analyst and somatic experiencing person and really look at what was happening for me. What was that about? Why was I being activated? And get some tools of learning how to fall asleep. I mean, again, and of course, there's some other stuff.
What do you think it's about?
Well, I thought of, there were several incidents. One was when I was young, my father, who had all that covert, you know, incest stuff, I'd be lying in bed. And I would be in fear, even though he was not coming in. It wasn't like a molest situation. He had no boundaries. And I would hear the footsteps come to the door and he'd open the door. And then sometimes he'd come in and he'd sit at the end of my bed and he'd start rubbing my leg and talking to me. And there was a part of me that always knew that this was inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? And it would be right at nighttime, right after the lights went out. And that's what was happening with Tom. It was like right after the lights went out, the anxiety would start. So I started to connect it to those events. And there was another event as well around being woken up. So yeah, it was like, I literally went to this hypnotist was one thing I did. And we walked through the trauma and she did these certain exercises with me. I did some somatic work. I talked about it in therapy, and I can honestly say I can fall asleep now. So, I mean, but it took a while, Andrea. It really did. And again, did I even know that was there? No. Had no idea it was there.
Were there any thoughts in your head, like, when you'd feel the anxiety in your body? Like, were there any, like, worrisome thoughts, or was it just, like, the fear of I'm not going to be able to fall asleep?
It was literally just this panic. And that's why I knew it was more in my body, because there was, when I would use my rational brain and when I would say, he's safe, like he was a safe person. So it wasn't like I was unsafe. And that was why it was so hard to figure out initially, because I thought, I'm not scared of him. He's a very safe person. I could wake him up and he would comfort me. So it was so physiological. It just wasn't about him. You know,
where has codependency shown up in the relationship for you?
Endlessly.
Do tell.
Yeah. I mean, he has something called Brown's Accord. He was an extreme skier. He was an skier and he was a drinker and he had tons of falls and he was not someone who took care of his body. So like 5 years ago, he was skiing and he couldn't lift up his foot. And long story short, Brown's Accord is a spinal injury. So it's an injury on your spinal cord. And he got to a point where he was having trouble walking. So he's had this entire recovery. He's had a surgery on his neck. He's had a surgery on his lower back. And he struggles sometimes with fine motor skills. So he'll be getting dressed in the morning and he'll be putting his socks on and I'll see there's one of his feet. It's really, and I'll want to go over and do it. I mean, that's just a small thing. But if I played into my codependency, I would be doing like half the stuff for him. And what I know about codependency is, and I always say this to you, it doesn't work for the person and it doesn't work for me. That's the delusion of codependent behavior, is the other person is just going to get resentful and they're not going to feel empowered, or they're going to become victims and expect you to do everything for them. So it is completely disempowering for the other person. And it's disempowering for me because eventually I'm going to get resentful. So that's the thing about codependency. It just doesn't work for anybody. And so there's always opportunities to keep my mouth shut. And we talk about it. I mean, he's got his own codependency also. And another thing I've learned is seeing it from the other side of someone wanting to be codependent with me, I have had the experience now of what it's like when someone wants to manage me. And it is infuriating. And so that's been really good because, oh my God, I've done that. I've made people feel this way. Like, that's the other thing. We forget that it's completely disempowering to other people. So that's been a really good thing.
What has been in the situation with wanting to help him? How have you managed to balance it or figure out, like,
yeah,
helping someone, like being in a loving relationship and like being, you know, yeah, like caring and loving versus what's crossing the line?
I think we're always talking about that because he'll often say, oh, you're just doing that because you love me. And I think to me, it's the source. If I'm coming from fear or a feeling inside my body, like an urgency, it's a have to. If I'm coming from, oh my God, honey, can I help you do that? And I'm calm, it's a loving thing. I think it's all the source of the behavior, because I believe codependency behavior, survival behavior is always coming from a fear. And there's like this urgency to it. And that's a different energy. So keeping the communication channel open also, because sometimes I'll say to him, wow, I want to control and manage you right now. I want to say this. And he'll say, no, that would be helpful. So it's talking about it as well, keeping the dialogue going in the relationship.
How have you guys handled conflict?
What's interesting.
Well, who are you? Are you somebody that wants to fix it right away? Or are you somebody that needs to take a break and then we'll talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think we've done pretty well. We've had one experience where we had a pretty big fight and it took us a few days to get it together. But in general, I think if I call it an activation, if I'm feeling angry or upset, and because of all the work I've done, I'll say to him, I'm having a reaction in my body right now. So I got to calm down and either let me call you back or can I talk about it or whatever. And he'll do the exact same thing. If he's on the phone and I say something and all of a sudden he has a rage response, we have a language to talk about it. I mean, to me, 95% of getting through conflict is if you can own the reaction instead of taking it out on your partner. I mean, I do believe that our reactions are our responsibility. Nobody's doing it to me. So that's huge. Yeah. I mean, it's ownership. If you can both own your part, I think you can have a great relationship. And we're not perfect. I mean, you know what I mean? I've gotten upset a couple of times, but we quickly reel it in and own it and can talk about it. And I think it really is about when you're aware of your stuff and when you know it's your responsibility, it creates a great dynamic in your partner. I mean, I always say the only thing required for a really good relationship is a willingness and an ownership. And if you have a partner that can own their stuff, you're halfway there. I mean, don't you think?
How long has it been? How long have you guys been seeing each other?
March will be 2 years. So
wow,
it's like,
look at you.
Yeah. I mean, and I do feel as though, and I shouldn't even say that, but I feel like this is it. Like he's got enough great qualities that I can see like having, and he's someone that I know I can do the work with. That's the other thing that, yeah, I see this being it. I mean, we'll see. We'll see if I talk to you again. But it is great. I mean, he's got the willingness and he's a really sweet person and he's sober though. So you're right. I mean, who knows what can happen?
I wanted to ask you, with your son, have you had experience where he's come to you to talk about how his childhood has impacted him? Have you had those conversations?
I mean, we've had a lot of conversations. I mean, the thing is, I think I did parenting really well. And, you know, we've talked about George and that period of our lives. And he was here from kindergarten to both fifth grade. So like 5 years. And yeah, and it is interesting because he saw George. George watched him every Tuesday, picked him up at school, and he has all these positive memories of that time. And so he doesn't remember like seeing him wasted or anything like that, because that wasn't how George showed up. But my son really talks more about how being in kind of a divorced home. Like, I want to tell you lastly, just this really quick story. When he was three or four, he was in daycare. And he had a best friend, and the best friend on a certain night would go to the best friend's house for dinner. And then I would work late and pick him up there. And I had left his dad when Bo was 6 months old. So I went to pick him up one night and the mom said, can I talk to you for a minute? And I said, sure. And when the father came home from work and sat down, Bo started speaking with him and he said, you live here? And the father said, yes. And he said, well, you don't have your own house like my dad? And it was like my son's reality was that both parents had their own home. Like, that was his reality for those early years. He didn't think something was wrong with that. And it's just so fascinating to talk about that with him, because then when I married George, when he was, I think I got married when he was in like first grade or something. And then George and I got divorced. George left. He was in fifth grade. And he then had this, you know, he's older. And I remember he came to me and he said, I don't know how to tell my friends what happened, you know, and he was having the shame because his friends all knew George and now George wasn't there. So, I mean, it was that critical time, like starting in fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, when your friendships are like critical. What other people think of you is really important. Girls, all of that stuff. So we talked through a lot of that. And later in his life, he asked me why he didn't go to George's funeral. And so we had to work through that. But I'm going to say that again.
How old was he when George died?
He was like 11, something like that. And I will tell your audience that to me, the most important thing you can do as a parent is resolve your own issues. Like parenting stuff, so many people focus on how to parent and what all these tips of what you do with your kids. And I'm telling you, when I went to Al-Anon, I went to Al-Anon when I was pregnant. And Al-Anon and the work I did with codependency, to me, in working with parents over the years, is the number one thing that saved me from getting in his business and being a controlling mom. Like, we've talked about it over the years, and I really worked my ass off at working on when something was happening for me to own it and not let it get in the way of my relationship. And, you know, he's a dynamite kid right now. I mean, and he's, you know, and he has relationships and he, you know, I mean, and I've seen tons of his friend and witnessed parents and how they've been with their kids. And putting our own stuff on our kids unconsciously or consciously is the thing that'll damage those relationships. Seriously, that is the thing you can do. Oh, yeah.
Have you noticed on social media at all, like there is, I don't know a lot, but I've seen some of it where it's targeted to parents who have been cut off by their kids, but it's like, you know, you victim, like, oh, your kid's been brainwashed. It's basically like absolving the parents of any sort of responsibility in it.
Right.
And I actually was supposed to do an interview last week and I misread the email. I thought this person had written a book about being adult children being estranged from their narcissistic parents.
Okay.
The book was actually about parents being estranged from their adult children because their adult child married a narcissist who convinced their child to disconnect from their parents.
Disconnect from the family.
Yeah. And so totally believe that's a thing, right? But I read through the book, you know, to see, because I could also see a narcissistic parent using that as an excuse as to why the child cut them off. And so I wanted to see, like, is there anything in this, anywhere in this book where it's asking the parent to reflect like at them? And nothing, not a single thing. And there was even like a chapter in the book where it was like false allegations. And it was like, your child might start saying this stuff to you out of nowhere. I'm rethinking my childhood. I think that my upbringing may have been toxic. I think I'm in therapy now, and I think that I might have experienced trauma. And like basically alluding to, if your kid says this to you, that it's just that their narcissistic partner is ingraining it in their head.
Wow.
And it's like, this is all the shit that my audience says to their family.
Exactly.
I just wrote her and I said, I can't have you on my show. Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, not helpful. Wild. And again, I'm not saying that like there aren't circumstances where like this happens And maybe a kid is saying those things because their partner ingrained it in their head, you know? I'm not saying that that's not a thing. Like, it totally does happen. But there also has to be a part where there's a reflection, and especially just giving my audience, I have to be protective because,
absolutely.
You know. So. But a little bit disturbing, especially, like, I don't know.
If you're not a parent that has feelings about some stuff you've done, I mean, that's just normal. I mean, my gosh, especially in the community, you know, people that have drank and then get sober. I mean, that's a whole other arena. In fact, I often say parents, the clients I've had, it takes a long time for them to even get to or be willing to talk about what happened when they were drinking with kids, because it is, there's so much shame and guilt and remorse and regret. And the problem with that is they overcompensate and they don't set boundaries. And then they create a world where they're like prisoners to their kids. I mean, it's like, I've seen it over and over and over again.
That might be something actually just to dip into briefly to talk about in case there are some people listening that are struggling with that.
Yeah.
So how do you,
I know, yeah.
Yeah. Whatever, wherever you want to go with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's again, it's working on yourself. It's that forgiveness thing we're talking about. It's like, you know, it's that very fine line that you're actually talking about now, which is I need to forgive myself for the stuff I've done. I mean that, and I need to make things right as best I can. I can't, you know, force someone to forgive me or have a relationship with me, but I am responsible for making things right as far as my part goes. So I think the trouble, and I've talked to, I remember doing a talk, I think on Zoom, to a sober moms community. And that was so many of them. The questions were, oh my gosh, how do I set a limit with my 4-year-old or do this or do that? And I have all these book recommendations. But it's not about the limit setting. It's about what happens for the person to, when they try to set a limit with their kids. And we forget they're these tiny little beings, but they give them so much power. And it's really a thing. And it's forgiving yourself and doing your own work and whatever recovery program you have to get sober and deal with that piece. And then realizing doing some of this codependency work because, and I do give examples with my son along the way, because it's learning about that it's not helping your child to enable your child and to come out of guilt as a parent. It just, if you can think about it, like you're doing the best thing as a parent to try to have courage and strength to kind of get a little detaching from the past and know that you're starting fresh. And the problem is a lot of kids who haven't had boundaries because their parents have been alcoholics are kind of running roughshod and they're in shock that their parent is starting to set boundaries. So it's going to be harder before it gets easier. But I'm telling you, it is the most kids want boundaries. I mean, that's the other things. And I could get into a whole tirade about parents these days and the over, you know, the overdoing for their kids, overgiving, overdoing, overcontrolling. I mean, it's like a huge phenomenon. Outside of alcoholic parents, it is. And it just does no service to the kids to not have consequences for their behaviors. It just doesn't. I mean, they don't learn how to be regular human beings. So do yourself a favor and work on some forgiveness and compassion for yourself and just doing the right thing as a parent. And forget it. It's not about, this is the other thing. It's not about being liked by your child. If you're doing a good job, your kid isn't going to like you a lot of the time. I mean, I had an experience, I think you might have seen this in the book, about where I took my kid and a bunch of his teenage friends to the movies. And I had told him I wasn't going to take him to an R-rated movie because I wasn't going to go into and yet another horror film on a Friday night. And he, of course, didn't tell his friends that I wasn't going to do this. And we're at the front of the line, huge line behind us. And he gives the name of the movie. And I looked at him and I said, Bo, I'm not going into that movie. And he said, you told me that you were. Of course, a lie. I didn't tell him that we were going to do that. And I said, no, I'm not doing it. And he got really upset and because all his buddies are there. And now he's looking like he's not going to look right. And I start walking away and I said, look, you guys figure it out. And he turns around and in front of like 50 people, he screams at me, I hate you. And I was like, and you know what? I had had enough recovery at that point that I didn't respond and I walked outside. And he eventually came to me. They went to another movie and the next morning he apologized to me. But if I had reacted to that, like some parents would, that would have been a complete shit show. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the type of stuff that by doing your own work, you know, kids are going to activate us constantly. And it's our job as the adults to not react. And that's, you know, codependency work. Anyways.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything that you'd like to promote?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, the Leaving Crazy Town, I write articles for the Sober Curator magazine, and I've been doing some videos with Therapy in a Nutshell. It's a mental health YouTube channel. And I also forgot to say that I meant to say on your podcast that a woman who had heard my previous podcast wrote to me and I lost her email. And she told me this horrendous story. I think her husband had killed himself. And I just always felt so guilty. So if you hear this podcast, please write me again. Felt so bad about that. I'm sure you get tons of email.
It happens.
Yeah. Anyways.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, my sweet friend. You are the best. Love you. Let it all go. What you